Many of you by now, I think, know that I've been pursuing the idea that appears in the physics literature of matrix algebras of increasing dimension converging to the two-sphere or other spaces. And these other spaces really are coadjoint orbits. I'll make all of this clear. And I'm at the point where I made sense of what this convergence means, and that won't be a part of my talk today. And I have stuff that I haven't, it's only partly written up on convergence of vector bundles and so on. But one of the items that I'd like to understand is the situation for Dirac operators, because the physicists in their literature, they say, okay, you have Dirac operators over here, and therefore you have Dirac operators on these matrix algebras. But they don't make that very clear. In fact, they really don't treat much more than the simplest case of the two-sphere. And in the case of the two-sphere, there are at least three inequivalent definitions of Dirac operators, and they have different spectrum and so on that appear in the physics literature, and there are only scattered papers for other spaces, and I don't see at all what is going on there, and so I'd like to sort that out, and I'd like to have some notion of Dirac operators on these matrix algebras that converge in some undefined, as of now, undefined way to the Dirac operators on these spaces. And in order to do that, I need to know what the Dirac operators on these other spaces are. So I set about to learn about that. And to my surprise there, that really isn't worked out in the literature. So I'm going to show you what I've come up with so far. This is I'm still working on this, but at least one piece of it I have under control, and it's a fairly attractive story and relatively elementary. And I hope this will be a good after lunch, relatively easy talk for all of you. So let me start. This is all going to be for G compact. Well, let's see, connected, compact, semi-simple Lie group. So just think about SUN and SON, and if you just keep those examples in mind, I mean, that will be quite enough for this talk. And you have the Lie algebra, and you have the adjoint action of the group on the Lie algebra. If you think of all of this, and if you think of these as groups of matrices and the Lie algebra being other matrices that you can actually exponentiate down, then the adjoint action is this conjugation of elements in the Lie algebra by elements of the group. And then you have the dual space of the Lie algebra and the corresponding coadjoint action, and you can look at orbits in there under this action, and that's what we're going to look at. We're going to say let mu sub zero belong to the dual of the Lie algebra, and I want to take this to not be the zero element, because otherwise it's just a fixed point for the action and not interesting. And what we're going to see is that just from the choice of this element, there's a lot of canonical structure that comes, and anything that's canonical in terms of this, I'm going to label with a sub-zero. So that's what's going to tell you what comes out canonically. So you have the orbit, if you want, add star, I'll just put a big G there on mu, and then, you know, I'm going to disobey what I just said. I'm going to let K equal the stability group. These are the S's in G such that add star S of mu sub zero is equal to mu sub zero, and then the orbit is naturally identified with G over K, and we're really going to be looking working with G over K. That's easier to do, but everything you do here can be transferred to the orbit itself. So we want to know about Dirac operators on G over K. And there's let me just say a buzzword, and I will explain what this means. This gives a whole Kähler structure, and I will explain what that means as we go along. But to get going, we'll let K equal the Lie algebra of the stability group K. I should say that for what I'm doing, I don't need the full structure of semi-simple Lie algebras and so on. The only item that I really need, although we'll be imitating some of the structure theory in a mild way, the only element that I need is that if you look at the killing form, which is what the killing form of XY, which is the trace of add X, add Y, that for a semi-simple Lie group, that is negative definite, and I'm going to let this with one L, just because we'll have other inner products around, and I just want one that's very distinct, be the negative of killing form, so that we have this is all on G, the killing form for G. That's a piece of structure on G. We aren't making any choices for that. Okay. So, but the important thing is that it's positive definite and it's add invariant. In other words, under the adjoint action, the group G acts as orthogonal transformations for. Excuse me. Well, I was going to say. I guess I really meant 4G. All right, on the Lie algebra, sure. Okay. So because this. The killing form is ad invariant, and because when you let K act by the adjoint action on G, it certainly is carrying the subalgebra little k into itself, and we have an orthogonal action here. There's going to be an orthogonal complement, so let M. Will M be the orthogonal complement for this? I'll call it the killing form. It's the negative, and this is K invariant. Okay, and now to treat this space, we want the algebra of, I'll everywhere use smooth functions on here, but what I want to do, because for matrix algebras I can't use any local arguments, I want to do everything without any local arguments at all, everything be global, and we can really do that by essentially always working with functions on G. So I'm going to let this be the C infinity functions on G, such that f of xs equals f of x for x in k, x in g, s in k. Okay, so that certainly is the equivalent to the functions on here. And then I want to have the tangent space for g over k, and really as sections of a module, and I really wanted acting as derivations on this algebra, and it's well known in the literature that this complementary space M here serves well as the tangent space over the coset that corresponds to the identity element of the group, and a convenient way for us to deal with all of this is the following. And again, this is going to be I'm writing this for tangent space, but I'm really working with the sections of it. So this is going to be forgetting what notation I tend to use for that. Not that it. Oh, I know. W belonging to C infinity of G with values in M such that W of XS. A lot of these constructions are going to look they really are induced representations in a sense. And this is going to be, add S of W of X such that X belongs to K, to G, S belongs to K. And the way those act as derivations, so for F in our algebra A and W in the tangent space, the derivation for W on F at X is just the derivative. You look at F of X and here you put the exponential map T of W at X. Yeah, there's a question of how many parentheses I need here, but so you check that this, that the result of this really is again a function that is in A, and this gives a derivation, and this is the appropriate formula. So what, because of this kind of pattern, it really means that you can do all your calculations essentially on the subspace M, and then just as we've done here for the tangent space, by essentially left translation, so on. You can carry all of the structure over as long as you're a little bit careful with the formulas that you use. So I'm really not going to use this formula here. We're going now just work on M. And you're supposed to understand that all the things I do on M can be, in a simple way, carried over to the whole space G over K. Okay. So the first piece of structure that's readily available as in this situation and as part of the Kähler structure is there's supposed to be a symplectic form, and I'll denote it this way, and this is well known. So this is for x and y now in M. This is simply going to be mu zero of the bracket of x and y. Okay, and this is the Kirilov constant, or maybe it's constant comes in, I don't know. Kirilov-Suryo
symplectic form, and it's very well studied certainly in more general situations than this, and it's clearly skewed. You change the order of these two, and you get the negative. It's k invariant, just because k is the stability group of mu sub zero, and the important thing is that it's non-degenerate on M, and basically as a form its radical is k, so on. So that those are all very standard facts, and I don't want to discuss them. But that's very right on the surface. The next piece is where the setting that I'm starting out with is the hard part, namely that you're then supposed to have a complex structure, and once one has the complex structure and the symplectic form, then the Riemannian metric comes immediately. I mean that's the third piece that comes here in the setting, and given any two of those pieces, you get the other. Just by simple formulas that I will give later. So we want complex structure on M, and this complex structure is important for getting the Riemannian metric. But also, if you look. Well, for instance, in the Green Book of Graziabondia and Verrilli and Figueroa and the treatment of Dirac operators there, they emphasize that to construct a Dirac operator, it's very useful to have a complex structure around. And their treatment works just very nicely in this setting. And if I have time at the end, I'll just indicate how that all works out. But this complex structure is really the heart of the matter, and one does it by complexifying. It's easier to see by complexifying. So form the complexified space, and now using the fact that our killing form is non-degenerate, there is an element z naught in G such that mu naught of x is equal to killing form of x with z naught, okay, and what you find is that the add stability subgroup of this z naught. I mean, this is again a canonical piece of structure given mu is again k exactly as you would expect. And now what you do is you let T sub zero be the closure, this is in G, of, you look at, you simply exponentiate all of the scalar multiples of that. And this is T naught is a torus in G, and furthermore, since K keeps Z naught fixed, it leaves fixed all of these elements, and so certainly the closure, and so what you have is that T naught commutes with K. All the elements of T naught commute with all of the elements of K. And then what happens is that, you can use the adjoint action now restricted to T naught and acting on. I guess it's worth saying that the adjoint action of T naught on all of these, since T naught commutes with itself, it's going to leave all of these fixed and so on. So you have the T0 is contained in K. And then you consider the add action of T naught on the complexified space M super C. Okay? So now you simply have a torus group, and it's acting on a finite dimensional complex vector space, and under that action, the complex space is going to decompose into irreducible representations. The irreducible representations are all one-dimensional. I mean, that was the reason for moving into the complex situation where you can see how things work out. And for any given character of T naught, you can lump all of the elements together that transform according to that particular representation, that one-dimensional representation, and all of those characters, one-dimensional, different one-dimensional representations, will give you the different isotypic components, and if I let T0 be the Lie algebra of T0, these are all going to be given by linear functionals on T naught that So I can. I mean, the point is this still is a real group, and this should be thought of as real Lie algebra. And on here, those one-dimensional linear functionals are all going to take pure imaginary values. But that's all right. So let this is supposed to look like root spaces or something like that, and it's really the same flavor of things. Be the set of linear functionals on T0 corresponding to irreducible representations of T naught in this space. And as I said, they all take pure imaginary values. And for alpha in this space, let MC alpha be the corresponding isotypic component, i.e. the part of the space on which the action of T0 when lifted to the Lie algebra looks exactly like this linear functional. Okay. So we have M sub C is the direct sum of the M sub C alpha. Alpha belongs to this space. Well, when I complexified here, you should keep track of that, and on this complexified space you have the corresponding complex conjugation action. So let's let this is good for your notes, but let's let theta be the complex conjugation on MC that remembers the fact that you have the just M in there as a real form, and that commutes with the action and so on, and what you have is the theta of M alpha is going to be M of minus alpha. So in particular, if alpha, and this is a bijection, if alpha belongs to this space, then minus alpha belongs to this space. Okay. Also, you can certainly let T0 act actually by the adjoint action on all of G or G complexified, and the basically the, if you do that, the complexification of our little k is exactly by definition, it's exactly the subspace where the action is by the zero the trivial representation. And since M is the orthogonal complement of that, there's no zero representation in here. Zero does not belong to here. And the complexification of C is equal to the complexification of K direct sum all of these spaces, and this is the zero space, and these are non-zero spaces. You have that full decomposition. And now, once you have all of that, the consequence of this is that if you chase back that alpha, if alpha is in here, then alpha on Z naught is not equal to zero. Basically, if you chase back and if it equal to zero, let me not try to give you the argument, but it's a simple argument. Okay. So we can do the following. Set the positive part of this, the set of alphas, such that, and we have to remember that these are purely imaginary valued. So on Z naught, this would be a purely imaginary number, and so when I multiply it by I, this will be real, and if you think of this as being I times some positive number multiplied by another I, that makes it negative. So we'll put that as being less than zero. And similarly, zero minus is the set of alpha such that I times alpha of Z naught is greater than zero. So this is like a positive group system, and it's the same kind of idea, except that this is more elementary, and we don't need a whole lot of information about it. And I won't write it down, but certainly the theta, the complex structure that we're giving. Let me just skip that in view of time. Okay. All right. So now, we'll now define our complex structure. J sub zero. So again, this is canonical. And notice everything here is canonical. I mean, I've had to choose which one of these to give the plus sign and the minus sign to, but there are later things where one sees that which choice one should have made. Namely, if for x belonging to one of these spaces, okay, j naught of x is going to be I times x if alpha belongs to the plus space, and it's going to be minus I times x if alpha belongs to the minus space. And you notice that the characteristic property of this operator is that when you square it, you get minus the identity operator. This is going to be on all of MC. So that's the characteristic property minus the identity. Okay, just like I, when you square it, gives you minus one. Okay. So that's the important piece of structure that we need, and this commutes. J naught commutes with the K action and with theta, and it has other nice properties. Okay, I think yes. All right, so that's the complex structure, and again, you can see it's really quite canonical. And then once you have those two pieces, you define an inner product I'm still in the complex situation. Bilinear form. This is G sub zero, not to be confused with the Lie algebra, but this is standard notation for this on M complexified by G sub zero of X, Y, is equal to, you look at the symplectic form that we had, and you take x, well, you have a choice of which variable you want to make the linear variable. So once you have the two earlier pieces of structure, this comes right out. And then what you find is when you restrict g0 to m, okay, it is a definite inner product. That's of course K invariant. Okay. And with that one can along the lines here, which I won't sketch out at the moment, one can use that to define a Riemannian. So this goes to a Riemannian a G invariant Riemannian metric on G over K. Okay. So that's the Riemannian metric whose Dirac operator that I'm interested in. But just to get some key properties to give you some feeling for this, for alpha in the positive part here, let n sub alpha equal the set of x plus theta x, such that x belongs to m complexified. And this is clearly invariant under applying theta, so this is now contained in M. And you can see it's made up of something. I mean, this piece is going to be in here, but this piece is going to be in the same space with a minus alpha here. Things get a little confused here. And you have that M is the direct sum of these N alpha. And basic, yeah, I think I can put it down here, sort of basic properties is that if alpha and beta belong to this space, alpha not equal to beta, then G zero of let me put it this way, symbolically M alpha beta is equal to zero, and that's the same in the these are orthogonal for the Killing form also. Excuse my squeezing things in the end here. What's more interesting is that we can do it as a general thing. If x belongs to n alpha and y belongs to m, so y will have different pieces in different ones of these n alphas, and for a lot of the pieces you're going to get zero here, but you nevertheless can write down the general formula that g zero of x y is going to be the absolute value of alpha of z naught times the Killing form on x, y. Okay. So this is telling you that g naught strongly depends on the z naught that you've picked, and you can. Going way back to this torus, you can certainly find many other z's that generate through this exponential map generate exactly the same torus, and they will have the same stability subgroup as K, and so on. So this torus depends a little bit weakly on the z sub zero. But over here, you see that the Riemannian metrics depend strongly on the specific z sub zero chosen. Whereas again, the complex structure doesn't depend very strongly on it. I mean, it just depends on the decomposition of these subspaces and not. So this is certainly saying that in general you can have you can have lots of different Riemannian metrics, G invariant ones, on G over K, and they would be given by different choices of Z naught that give the same symplectic structure, and that those are some choices. All right. So as soon as you, okay. So let me just say that also that since J naught commutes with theta, J naught of M, and that M is carried into itself, and this is what puts a complex structure on this real vector space. Okay.
So J naught makes M into,
let me,
into a complex vector space,
simply because if you want to multiply an element in M by the complex number I, the definition, you simply apply J0, J sub 0. Okay, so it's perfectly transparent, although seeing what it's actually doing on M in terms of everything that went here is a little bit complicated. But once you have all of this, I mean, this works fine. So this is a complex vector space, and when we view M as a complex vector space, I'll try to remember to write something like that. So it's the same set of vectors, it's just that we now know how to multiply those vectors by complex numbers, because you multiply by the real part in the usual way, and then you multiply by the imaginary part by that real number time supplying this operator. Yes?
So that equal to 1?
You mean everywhere equal to 1? Ah, that's a very good question. Okay. And okay. Yeah, I guess I should have, I mean, for those who know what the words mean, these coadjoint orbits are usually not spin manifolds, but they are all spin C manifolds. And so you should be able to always construct Dirac operators and so on. But something which I'm avoiding here is you can certainly take the Killing form and restrict that to M. That's a perfectly good inner product, and you get a Riemannian metric. And that's going to be the one that gives you 1, and that does not come from this, from any Kähler structure of this kind. It doesn't come from any choosing any coadjoint vector and so on. And the consequence, I mean, that definitely complicates things. Yeah, what time am I supposed to, until, yeah, I have 6 minutes left, I guess. Okay. Well, we'll see what happens, but let me just say that the fact that it doesn't come from a symplectic structure means that at the moment I don't know how to get a nice explicit form for the Dirac operator for it. Whereas these that come from a Kähler structure, it all works out beautifully. So that was something I was going to say. And that I'm only now beginning to investigate the non-Kähler structure, having realized that it really is genuinely more complicated. In fact, I mean, I think I can. Well, let's see. Okay. So all of this extends to. I won't write it down. This all gives you. I mean, here I have this complex, but then that immediately makes the tangent bundle complex. You just apply J0 at every point in these are functions valued here. The G sub 0, just again applying pointwise, gives you a Riemannian metric. All of that works fine. And the next item that you need for a Dirac operator is a connection, I mean a Leibovitz-Civita connection. Okay. So you want a connection on the tangent bundle, and you want it to be G invariant. And so first of all, I mean, there's in this situation there's something that's called the canonical connection, but it's not what I have there, so I won't decorate it with a sub-zero, but it's sort of the obvious connection. So the canonical, maybe I'll put a C up there for canonical, for a W, I'm thinking for things
like this. So that's a vector field, and it's supposed to act on. And let's suppose that's another one of those. This is again is just the dTt equals zero of v at, well, this is supposed to be at x of x of t w of x. I mean, the same kind of formulas I used here for taking the derivative of functions someplace, yeah, right here. That works equally well for taking derivatives of these vector fields. So this is an obvious connection, you know, canonical for the situation. Okay? But it's except in the fairly special situation where you have a symmetric space. And that happens in this case, but most of the time it doesn't. And let me not go into that. So except in that case, this is not torsion free. But if you use the killing form as your Riemannian metric, which is again pretty canonical for the situation, but not what I want to do over there, it's known how to fix that up. I should say that any two connections differ by just a map from vector field to the endomorphism algebra. I mean, let me not expand on that. So I don't have to do any more derivatives. I have to look I have to add to this operators. So if I look at I need to do this plus L, let's say W, where the formula that's well known, this on V is half of this is supposed to be it. I should have an X over here also. This is the projection, the orthogonal projection of G onto N. If you add this term, this is torsion free, okay, and is the Levi-Civita connection if you used a killing form on. Okay, so that's quite standard. What we need to do, one way to approach this is to say, okay, we have now a torsion-free connection. How do we fix it up so that it's the Levi-Civita connection for this G naught that we have here? And that certainly was not in the literature, and I worked that out. And so then in Kobayashi and Numitsu, their two-volume work on differential geometry, they have a nice proposition that says if you have a torsion connection, how do you fix it up to be the Levi-Civita connection for the given Riemannian metric, and if you work through, and it's a substantial calculation, but it. You add, let's say G zero, it's this on. Well, let me just write x and y here, and not put in the variables x. I mean, again, everything happens on M, and you just translate it. So it's 1/2. Alpha plus beta on z naught. I haven't talked about this, but I mean, sometimes these are not in the weight space, and in that case, the convention is this is supposed to be zero. I think that winds up from the rest of the formula anyway. And here you have alpha of z naught p of x y plus beta of, let me write this where it's clear, beta of z naught of p of j zero x j zero y. And all, there it is in all its glory. Okay? So you can really write it down. So this term has to be added to these two to get the Levi-Civita connection. But you can write it down very explicitly, and also it makes very clear that it's strongly dependent on the choice of z0, as you would expect. Okay. I think all I should say is that the crucial, just to clarify what's going on here, the crucial dilemma is that if you look at this LC plus L of G0, this commutes with J0. In other words, if I put an X here, then as an operator in the other variable, it commutes with J0. This in general does not, in general, commute with J0. And that's exactly where the difficulty comes in defining the Dirac operator for the killing form, which just includes this term, as opposed from this Kähler structure where you actually have commutation. And once you have commutation this piece very easily commutes, so that's a problem. So once you have the Levi-Civita connection commuting with a complex structure, you look in the Green Book and you just follow the pattern that they have there, and everything just works out beautifully for defining the Dirac operator. Whereas if you don't have that commutation, you see nowhere have I had to mention spin groups or any of that kind of stuff. And if you don't have this commutation, there are things which I don't yet understand that talk about extending to the spin principal bundles over the spin group and things of that kind. I mean, I sort of understand the words, but I have not seen how to use those words in order to get explicit formulas of the kind that I have here. So if anybody has any experience with that situation, I would certainly be happy to hear their comments, but I should stop here.
Thank you.